Sure is.
From deep inside your radio.
From Miami, Florida, ladies and gentlemen. Isn't that wild? Just think about that. This is a program, as you know, that never has a theme. But if we had a theme today, a theme, not a theme song, a theme for all the, to unify all the elements, I guess it would be, it's a nutty old world. First of all, I never thought I'd hear a better alibi than, we were just wrestling. But I've heard one this week. And before the week, shuffles off, forgotten, I want to make sure we memorialize and salute maybe the best alibi ever. I just was buying some meth. What a great alibi. Accused of patronizing a gay prostitute for 3 years, having a three-year-long affair with a gay prostitute, Ted Haggard's first alibi was, no, we weren't having sex. I was just buying some meth. Man, I got to remember that. Of course, he failed to really state the moral case for why that was a good thing to be doing, and unfortunately has been fired by his church as a result. But the meth he bought, he threw it away. And it could have been bought by somebody who was going to use it. So he kept meth out of the hands of a meth user just by buying it. Now, if all of us, ladies and gentlemen, would just buy some meth every... Okay, so there's that. Now, I've been on this book tour. And thanks to the lovely people in Chicago who came out and the people in Indianapolis who came down to visit with me. And this week, Detroit, Michigan on Wednesday. At, the evening sometime. And then, Santa Monica, Southern California, Barnes & Noble on 3rd Street at 7 o'clock Thursday. You be there. I want the excuse in writing. Anyway, I've been so many fascinating places. Here, Miami Beach, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry, Miami. Miami Beach is a different city. And if you're wondering where all your construction cranes are, if you've got construction projects in your city, and they're not really starting because there are no cranes. They're here. They're all here. This is like you just drive around downtown Miami, and it's like a construction crane convention. They're all here because every block, a new 60-story building is going up, so they can have a better view of the 60-story buildings surrounding them. And you know, as a part-time New Orleanian, ladies and gentlemen, who has heard more than once, well, you know, you guys should be thinking about stuff for next time before you rebuild. I'm looking at all these 60 stories full of windows thinking, yeah, they're going to be able to board those all up because they do, last time I heard, have hurricanes in Miami too. But, you know, so what? So you're walking down the street and there are 60-story buildings on all sides with windows and a hurricane. But I was just in Chicago, and a presumably knowledgeable person explained something to me that I had not understood. There is this new trend, and I've noticed it mainly in Chicago, although my hotel here in Miami has it too, so maybe it's not. But anyway, the explanation of the phenomenon of the hotel with the seventh floor lobby. You walk in to the ground floor. There's no lobby there. Which to me, that's why do you have a ground floor at all if you're not going to put a lobby in it? You have to take an elevator to the seventh floor to reach the lobby. And then you can take another elevator, a totally different elevator, to get to your room maybe. So yes, ladies and gentlemen, in case of fire, you have to take two elevators to get out of the building. Well, that's nice, thoughtful. So the question might be, why? And the answer from a Chicago newspaper man, he should know. His company bought the newspaper in L.A. They should know. He said it's because that way it's less hospitable to the homeless if there isn't a lobby on the ground floor because there's, you know, nothing, no place for them to hang out. All right. I await correction, but that's the story I've heard so far. And which relates to other explanations. When I was in New York, you remember I fulminated about the eagerness of the city of New York to close streets, avenues, big old avenues to have. Forget the streets. Streets don't move anyway, but avenues, the big north-south thoroughfares, close those for parades. Because you wouldn't want to have the parade in the park. You want them on the avenue. That was about 3 weeks ago. As I left the studio that day, I was stuck in traffic for half an hour trying to get through a parade. It was Sunday. The Columbus Day Parade was the next day. But this was the Puerto Rican Columbus Day Parade. You see, they don't want to march with the Italians. They had to have their own parade. And the other thing that stopped traffic was a squadron, a platoon, a battalion, I don't know. I never learned those, of policemen on motorcycles driving up an avenue. And I said to the driver in my vehicle, I was lucky enough to have one who was talking to me, as opposed to most cab drivers now, ladies and gentlemen, in case you haven't taken a cab lately, especially in New York City, but even here in Miami, you get in the cab, you think they're talking to you, and then you realize, A, they're talking in a foreign language, and B, they're talking on their Bluetooth phone all the ride long. You may not have thought you signed up to hear a loud conversation in Urdu, but you did. Anyway, my driver said, yeah, those are the police, you know, they're just taking their motorcycles up the avenue. I said, really? Why? Is there a problem? He said, no, they just do it once a day. Makes you feel safe. Hello, welcome to the show. from just beside Biscayne Bay, I guess. I guess that's what that thing is. I'm Harry. This is Harry Shearer welcoming you to this week's edition of the show. And I'm here at WLRN Radio, one of the many fine radio stations throughout the country that doesn't carry this broadcast. And I'm looking at a, computer monitor, like you do, everything you do these days. And this one has two words at the bottom. I found out that they are the name of the software which runs the control panel here. And it's called, but these words are just, they're not flashing. They're just on the screen looking at me throughout this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, I just want you to know the words I'm seeing in front of my eyes are Integrity Administrator. We have an Integrity Administrator here. So I can't lie to you today. The Integrity Administrator is on duty. Reminding me of when I was in London and walking past a major church in Piccadilly, which said that one of its services, not, you know, its liturgical services, but one of the services it provided to the community was crisis listening. Yeah. That should be disturbing. That would be disturbing. Yeah. That would get me down, too. Crisis listening. You can call somebody in Bangalore and get that. All right, let's delve, because what a week. So, does this sound like victory? Does this sound like what the winners do? Dateline, New York. The Americans sold us out, says Ahmed Chalabi. Yeah. Ahmed Chalabi is turning on us, ladies and gentlemen. This is in the New York Times Magazine. He's betraying a touch of bitterness. Winners don't have that, do they? Quote, the real culprit in all this, says Chalabi, is Wolfowitz, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, whom he still considers a friend. They chickened out, says Chalabi. The Pentagon guys chickened out. The Americans screwed it up. It's a nice friendship you got there, Ahmed. That's not because they did too little, but too much. Chalabi thinks the U.S. should have exited quickly and turned things over to Iraqis like himself. It was a puppet show, he says, referring to the occupation. The worst of all worlds. We were in charge and we had no power. America betrays its friends. It sets them up and betrays them. I'd rather be America's enemy, unquote, Ahmed Chalabi. Is he talking about a victory? He, Chalabi does say that he was not the guy who was the source of the WMD accusations, or that is to say, they did not come at his initiative. He says, Bush officials came to us and asked, can you help us find something on Saddam? Chalabi, ladies and gentlemen. But wait, he's not the only one. Richard Perle, who was one of the original neocon advocates of the war. If he had his time over again, he would not have advocated an invasion of Iraq. He says this to Vanity Fair. I think if I had been Delphic and seen where we are today and people had said, should we go into Iraq? I think now I probably would have said, no, let's consider other strategies for dealing with the thing that concerns us most, which is Saddam supplying weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. I don't say that because I no longer believe that Saddam had the capability to produce weapons of mass destruction. I believe those two premises, and he was in contact with terrorists, were both correct. Could we have managed that threat by means other than a direct military intervention? Well, maybe we could have, unquote Richard Perle. Is that what the victors do? Kenneth Edelman, a lifetime neocon activist and Pentagon insider who, with Perle, was on the Defense Policy Board. He's famous for saying in February 2002, I believe demolishing Hussein's military power and liberating Iraq would be a cakewalk. Kenneth Cakewalk Edelman says in the same Vanity Fair article, I just presumed that what I considered to be the most competent national security team since Truman was indeed going to be competent. They turned out to be among the most incompetent teams in the post-war era. Not only did each of them individually have enormous flaws, but together they were deadly dysfunctional. Unquote. Unquote Kenneth Edelman. Does he sound like a victor? He says the idea of a tough foreign policy on behalf of morality, the idea of using our power for moral good in the world, is dead for at least a generation. After Iraq, he says, it's not going to sell. Unquote. I guess if he had it to do over again, Cakewalk Edelman says, I guess what I would have said is Bush's arguments are absolutely right, but you know what? You just have to put them in the drawer marked can't do. And that's very different from let's go. Yes, it is. It's almost the opposite, seems like to me. So the winners are gloating, ladies and gentlemen. Now, what's the situation on the ground? Dateline Kabul, Afghanistan. Afghan farmers are planting opium poppies, probably reaping a harvest comparable to this year's record crop. Insurgents are preventing effective counter-narcotics work. Drug production has skyrocketed since the U.S.-led offensive toppled the Taliban regime. Last spring's poppy harvest accounted for 92% of the global opium supply. So if you don't want to buy meth, if you're an evangelist and you don't want to buy meth and throw it away, the heroin will be coming from Afghanistan. It was enough to make more than 610 tons of heroin, more than all the world's addicts consume in a year. We have a heroin surplus. Should be driving the price down, but no. And a recent CIA assessment finds that the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has been significantly weakened by rising popular frustration with his U.S.-backed government. This according to U.S. officials in the New York Times. The assessment found that Karzai's government and security forces continued to struggle to exert authority beyond the capital. A senior U.S. official spoke only on condition of anonymity because he likes his parking place. The assessment also found increasing numbers of Afghans viewed Karzai's government as corrupt, failing to deliver promised reconstruction, and too weak to protect the country from the Taliban. So fortunately, Afghanistan isn't going the way Iraq is. That was Afghanistan I was talking about. Now, Iraq. Dateline Baghdad. This is from McClatchy Newspapers. Ali Abbas decided that his upper right thigh was the best place for a tattoo because no one gets tortured there. He'd seen hundreds of bodies in the city morgue and dozens of hospitals during his 18-day search for his missing uncle. He'd seen drill marks and swollen, often unrecognizable heads, slash marks across necks, bullet holes in backs, abdomens, and swollen hands. But by and large, the thighs had been intact. So that's where he decided to have his name, address, and phone number tattooed in case the day comes when someone has to search for his body. Tattoos are a sin in Islam. Tattoo shops are difficult to find in Baghdad. They're often in the basements of regular shops. But at least some are seeing more and more Iraqis who, like Abbas, are willing to risk offending his religion to ease their family's grief in the event of their deaths. The decision to tattoo reflects the country's level of violence. It seems that anyone can be kidnapped and killed for any reason. There are few Iraqis who haven't had to search for family members who've been kidnapped, tortured, and tossed in another neighborhood, or who know of someone killed by a homemade bomb, a shooting, or a car bombing, or taken on the way home from work, only to show up at the morgue days later. 100 families are found each day nationwide. Most people have been taken from one neighborhood and killed in another. In Baghdad, the morgue has become a Shiite-dominated wing of the Ministry of Health, which means that Sunnis fear to go there, dread to go there to pick up loved ones for fear they'll be kidnapped while they're there. Some police officers are afraid to approach bodies in their communities, fearing they've been booby-trapped. So they're tattooing themselves. Ladies and gentlemen, just like we are, but for different reasons, you know. It's just a cultural difference. This week, how's Parliament doing? How's our nascent democracy? For the second consecutive day, reports the L.A. Dog Trainer, Parliament was unable to convene because too few Iraqi lawmakers showed up. The Parliament Speaker engaged in a bitter exchange with a fellow Sunni lawmaker during a news conference at which the Speaker chided his colleagues for absenteeism. When the colleague spoke up, the Speaker lashed out and accused him of corruption. The TV station abruptly ended its broadcast of the news conference. You don't want to have that on TV. And then, what is the Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction finding? How about this? Of the 505,000 weapons that have been given to the Ministries of Interior and Defense over the last several years by us, serial numbers were properly recorded for only 12,000 of them. Weapons are just rocket-propelled grenade launchers, assault rifles, machine guns, shotguns, semi-automatic pistols, and sniper rifles. Dick Pearl was worried about Saddam turning non-existent nukes over to his non-existent terrorist friends. We have sent 505,000 grenade launchers, assault rifles, machine guns, shotguns, and semi-automatic pistols into Iraq, and properly recorded serial numbers for only 12,000 of them. Oh, 370,000 were purchased with American taxpayer money, so not all of them were our money. Despite the potential risks from losing track of those weapons, the United States recorded just a few thousand. There are standard regulations for registering military weaponry governed by the Department of Defense. The Inspector General's report said that when asked why so many weapons went to Iraq with no record of serial numbers, American military officials in Baghdad replied they did not believe the regulations applied to them. And the Inspector General's report also found that money for spare parts was allocated for only 5 of the 12 different kinds of weapons sent to Iraq. And when the Inspector General contacted units of the Defense and Interior Ministries over there, none actually knew how or where to requisition small spare parts. Another report by the Inspector General. The Iraqi government is spending very little of its own money on reconstruction projects. The process for handing off U.S.-funded works appears to have broken down. Beyond paying employee salaries and administrative expenses, only a small amount of money is being spent by the Iraqi ministries on actual work. Auditors find fault with the way the finance ministry is keeping track of U.S.-built projects as they're handed over. Some of the U.S. data on the subject are incomplete or inaccurate. Iraccurate would be the new word. Iraccurate. Thank you. I'm very proud of that. This, by the way, you'd think with these findings, the Inspector General's office supervising Iraqi reconstruction would be in trouble, and indeed they are. A little notice provision in this year's defense appropriation bill shuts them down October of next year because they might find more of this. And finally, in this list, according to the Washington Post, the list of alleged contractor misdeeds in Iraq has grown. Yet when it comes to holding companies accountable, the charges seldom stick. The rules for holding contractors in a war zone accountable remain uncertain, with few precedents to go by. It's accountability. We had an accountability moment. It was the election. So the by the way, senators in both parties are trying to keep the Inspector General's office from being shut down. Let's wish them luck, shall we? We don't have the music, but we do have a tale, ladies and gentlemen, of airport security from our very own San Diego desk. I'm quoting now. As I checked my bag at San Diego's Lindbergh Airport, I had a rather odd experience. I hefted my bag onto the scale and identified myself. The agent looked at her computer screen and said something to the effect, "This bag is very close to the weight limit, sir. If you get a lot of material at your conference, you may want to have them ship it." Unquote. The odd thing is, I did not tell her I was going to a conference. The airline reservation was not made via the conference site, since there was no official airline, and I did not tell the hotel what flight or airline I was on. The only thing I can figure is someone data mined my credit card transactions and gave the airline the information that I was attending a conference. Meantime, screeners at Newark Liberty International Airport failed 20 of 22 security tests covered by undercover U.S. agents last week, missing an array of concealed bombs and guns at checkpoints throughout the airport's three terminals. This, according to federal security officials, quoted by the Newark Star-Ledger. There are also significant failures by screeners to follow standard operating procedures while checking passengers and their baggage for prohibited items, said the officials of the security apparatus who spoke on condition of anonymity because they like their knees. "We can do better, and training is the path to improve performance," says Newark's security director, declining to address specifics. "Test results are not a grade or a scorecard," he says. "They're a roadmap to perpetual improvement. Any other characterization is simply misleading." Okay, tell that to your kids, babe. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we do have the music for this. a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Yes, it is. Time for me to read the trades for you. From Advertising Age, big marketers smell money in scent technology. And that's scent with a C. You know it is. I'll read it for you. Dateline New York. It's time to lead consumers by the nose. So goes the thinking at major packaged goods manufacturers including Mars, PepsiCo, Kraft, and Procter & Gamble, who hope scents will help them get attention among fragmented audiences. That's the problem with us, ladies and gentlemen. We're too fragmented. I know the feeling. Mars has recently used, not the planet, the manufacturer, has recently used scent technology to spread the aroma of chocolate around its M&M's World retail outlets and put Pedigree dog food scented stickers in front of supermarkets and pet stores. That's right. Same company's making your chocolates and your pet food. Just the way it is. Pepsi spread the smell of black cherry vanilla with inserts in People magazine and store displays for Diet Pepsi Jazz. They're naming a variety of Diet Pepsi after jazz. There's also been a whiff of activity sniffed out at Kraft and P&G, but neither would comment. And then there's Smell-O-Vision. Carmine Sant'Andrea, CEO of the multi-sensory communications vendor Sant'Andrea, is putting 8,000 scent delivery systems by that name into in-store flat panel screens in Kroger markets and other top retailers, including Walmart. In fact, Mr. Sant'Andrea, long a proponent of the sales-lifting ability of scent, has dubbed next year, 2007, the year of the scent. Our olfactory sense is the most primal of all the senses and is extremely powerful, much more invasive than reading or hearing something, says Jack Sullivan, Senior Vice President, Media Director for Starcom. Quote, why it's not used more often is beyond me, unquote. He did offer some reasons. There's always the possibility that an olfactory campaign might offend and huge concern over people with allergies. Yes. Cost and implementation hurdles have prevented Connie Garrido, president of the Mindshare sibling company, Wow, from going forward with media plans that involve attaching scent to transit shelters and bathroom mirrors. David Van Epps, president CEO of Scent Air, which has just signed on with Muzak to offer scent wherever there is sound and video. Let me out of here. Said he'd seen exponential interest recently from major packaged goods players for his products, which include retail displays with scented cartridges triggered by motion sensors. But he said there are hurdles. Even though the price has come down, it still isn't necessarily cost-effective to use scent technology for low-cost products such as bread or jam, where the sales lift would have to be incredibly high to ensure successful profit margins. It must be for a product where the aroma is crucial to the positioning, Mr. Van Epps said. And it must be clear what exact product a scent in the air is linked to. Otherwise, it can lift sales for the whole category rather than just the product that paid for it. But the costs are improving. Tad Acker, president of a display company, said the units it sold to Verizon Wireless stores recently to waft chocolate scent for LG chocolate phones were only $20 each, down from nearly $100 for such display pieces a few years ago. The phones, according to Joe Flamingo, not making these up, manager for Verizon Wireless in the Northeast, have been one of the most successful launches in Verizon history, and the scent played in that success. How much? Quote, enough for me to try it again. aroma every place there's sound and video. It's a wonderland. Or something. Doesn't the future look bright, ladies and gentlemen, when I read the trades for you? Copyrighted feature.
You take the east, take the west, take the north, I'll take the south. You take the Alps, take Paris. As for me, I'll take the south. Now, whether it's Virginia, Tennessee, or sunny Carolina, any place is heaven down below that old Mason-Dixie line. You take the east, take the west, take the north, I'll take the south.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Le Show, and it is, it's not Halloween anymore, but it's Simpsons Halloween episode is running late, as usual. So it puts me in mind of this. Rupert Murdoch has been caught between, this according to Fortune magazine, between two Manhattan residences, his old Soho loft, which he sold for $25 million, and his new Fifth Avenue apartment, which he bought for $44 million and is still renovating, even though he bought it 2 years ago. I know that feeling. With nowhere left to go, he and his third wife, Wendy Deng, have spent the last several months camping out at the swanky Trump Avenue Park apartment house, and News Corp has been paying the $50,000 monthly rent. We told you about that. That decision did not sit well with corporate governance gadflies. That's a job. Did they offer that to you at Career Day? Fortune has now learned Murdoch quietly decided to pay back the money. Quote, on reflection, Mr. Murdoch concluded it was more appropriate to cover the apartment expenses himself, said a spokesman by way of confirmation. That's nice. Roop, if you need some, you know where to get it. Clearly you do. Meanwhile, pop star George Michael has launched a scathing attack on the self-same Rupert Murdoch, labeling the media mogul, quote, the devil, unquote. The former Wham! Singer is stunned by his control over a large portion of the world's media. George, where have you been? Oh, we know. Sorry, didn't mean to ask. Didn't mean to remind you. He believes he, George Michael, is portrayed negatively in the mogul's papers and TV shows because he, George Michael, is a liberal homosexual. He insists he's been against Murdoch since the early days of his musical career, saying, quote, I think Murdoch is the devil and has been for 20 years. Who was the devil before then? Did I miss that election? He's been the devil for 20 years. I guess it has to rotate. There's so many candidates. Now, not everybody who wants to be the devil can be the devil, ladies and gentlemen. Quote, the only dignity, I'm quoting George Michael again, is in autonomy. I was so right about Murdoch. 20 years later, we have a media dictator. Michael claims his musical success began to slow down after his controversial song Shoot the Dog in 2002, which some perceived as anti-George Bush. Before 2002, Michael says, quote, I had an unflinching hold on the charts. Unquote. Everybody blames Hooper for something. Well, you know, when you're the devil, you got to take some heat or dish it out, one or the other. And now, ladies and gentlemen, something's going to happen here. Something's going to happen real soon. Yeah. It says it's happening, and yet I'm not hearing it. Isn't that wild? Isn't that wild when you go to a new station? Well, these are the apologies of the week. Screw the music. I hope something else works, though. Dateline Vero Beach, Florida, Electric Utilities Director Pete Lindberg. This is right near here, Vero Beach, where the Dodgers have spring training in it. No, they're still in Vero Beach, Vinny? I don't know. Ask Brokaw. Electric Utilities Director Pete Lindberg was suspended without pay on Monday. The city is taking steps to fire him, according to city manager Jim Gabbard. Lindberg, an 11-year city employee, was suspended with pay last week after a routine employee internet use checkup showed he visited adult pornographic websites using his city-owned computer. I apologize to anyone I may have inconvenienced, said 53-year-old Lindberg on Monday. If I have somehow hurt anyone or inconvenienced them in their daily duties, I humbly apologize. Turkish National Defense Minister Vekdi Gonul met with U.S. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld at the Pentagon this week and discussed the unfortunate map incident that occurred earlier this year. Gonul was greeted by Rumsfeld. At the beginning of the talks, Rumsfeld expressed regret for the unfortunate map crisis. And what was the map crisis? Oh, I see. The U.S. Lieutenant Colonel had displayed a map showing 18 different cities in Turkey that were mislabeled Kurdistan during a seminar at the NATO event earlier this year. So, yes, Rumsfeld has apologized for something, the unfortunate map incident. A diabetic man fell into a coma because airport staff refused to let him take his insulin on board a flight from Auckland, New Zealand to Christchurch. Qantas Airlines has apologized to TUI Peter Russell, who had a severe attack on the plane and was in the hospital for 2 weeks. Johns Hopkins University has suspended the Sigma Chi fraternity because of a Halloween in the Hood party that drew protests by black students. The invitation to the party posted on the Facebook website encouraged guests to wear regional clothing from our locale with jewelry including bling bling ice grills and hoochie hoops. Black student union members protested the party, saying the appearance of the image of a skeleton pirate hanging on a noose and the language on the invitation highlighted racial tensions and strained relations between the university and the surrounding community. University officials suspended all the fraternity's activities pending a full investigation. Sigma Chi apologized. National Sigma Chi. Oh, three men who identified themselves as Sigma Chi members stood up during a meeting, a campus forum Monday night, and apologized for the actions of the author of the invitation, calling it shameful. President of the Baltimore branch of the NAACP said he intends to explore legal action against both the fraternity and the university. And more university Halloween hijinks. 3 days after Halloween, the president of University of Pennsylvania, Amy Gutman, her costume lives on, thanks to the internet, and student Saad Sadi. He photographed the two of them, himself and the university president. He dressed as a suicide bomber and her as Glinda the Good Witch in The Wizard of Oz. Many questioned whether it was appropriate for the leader of the Ivy League university to pose with someone seemingly making light of Middle East terrorism. Saad has now apologized. Sadi has posted an apology on his website in which he says, "We express our condolences and sympathy to all offended by our costumes. We make it clear that we do not support terrorism, violence, or anything that is against society." Dateline Cheyenne, Wyoming, seeking to put an end to an incident that pundits say could tighten an already all campaign apologies. They're a dime a dozen. Don't take those seriously. Dateline Berlin, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has apologized for misunderstandings involving German forces and Israeli jets off the Lebanese coast and pledged they would not be repeated. The German government said Chancellor Angela Merkel had expressed her concern over the incidents of the past week in a telephone conversation with Olmert. Last week, Israeli jets fired in the air over a German intelligence-gathering ship in international waters. Israel denies the shots were fired. But the apology stands. Afghan authorities are investigating allegations that about 60 civilians were killed last week as a result of NATO operations in Kandahar province. Vinny?
Kandahar!
Sure. Where the Taliban was born. NATO Supreme Military Commander for Europe, U.S. Marine General James Jones, apologized to President Karzai for the incident, saying the bombing took place in the, quote, fog and heat of war, unquote. You don't want that fog and that heat. That hot fog can... A radio talk show host was fired this week after he made a derogatory comment about the weight and sexuality of a candidate running for Massachusetts governor. AM pulled host John DiPietro from the air after he called her, the candidate, a fat lesbian. And the vice president and general manager of the station has apologized. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, while calling into the radio program of somebody named Don Imu? I'm just bitter. Senator John Kerry this week said, I'm coming back to Washington today, so I'm not a distraction because I don't want to be a distraction to those campaigns. This has to do with the comment he made, speech he made, actually, in which he said, roughly paraphrasing, that I want to talk about education. You should stay in school. Work to be smart. That was the one I loved. Work to be smart. Didn't know you could do that. And otherwise, you'll get stuck in Iraq. Later examinations of the text he was scheduled to deliver revealed that what he was supposed to have said is, you'll get us stuck in Iraq, just ask President Bush. But he didn't say the us, and he didn't say the just ask President Bush. And so you know that there was this big foo-foo about it. And Kerry told Imu, quote, of course, I'm sorry for a botched joke. But of course, that's not the end of it. But we'll get back to that moments from now here on the show. Stand by.
Ride the intelligence of President. From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Up to Here. Up to Here, a daily once-over, not-so-lightly, of the story behind the tip of every iceberg. I'm Milton Getzler in Washington. When Senator John Kerry acknowledged this week that he had botched a joke written to deride the intelligence of President Bush, it was not the end of the story. That botched delivery, which allowed critics to interpret it as criticism of American troops at war, convinced Senator Kerry's advisers that if he were to proceed with his rumored return to presidential campaigning next year, a kind of makeover was required. Ira Zipkin reports.
Okay, good. You've got the opening out of the way. Keep going.
As a matter of fact, my wife Teresa is here tonight, and it's a good thing, or I might never afford, with the price of gasoline skyrocketing, to get my car out of valet parking later in the evening.
Ah, see, that sucked. Are you kidding with that? The price of whatever later in the evening after you kill with the word parking?
I just wanted to put the joke into context.
Can I tell you something? If I want context, I'll watch Law and Order.
It's 1:15 on Saturday morning, and we're in Dr. Laffenstein's comedy pit in suburban Providence, Rhode Island. Senator John Kerry is working out, as the comedians call it, doing a late night, or more accurately, early morning workshop with two veteran comedians to guide him, Joan Rivers and Yakov Smirnoff.
Let's try one of the switcheroos, Mr. Senator. You can't go wrong with them. What a formula.
All right. I do want to tell you folks that things are so bad in Iraq at the current moment.
No. See, too many words. Wasting audience's valuable time.
It tells me, you're nervous.
Well, I am nervous. These people out here are extremely intoxicated.
John, there's three of them.
Just say, in Iraq, and then go for it.
In Iraq, war loses over you. What a country.
What's with this over?
Well, it never hurts to add a preposition.
It does hurt. It hurt bad.
I think that one of my very strong points is that I learn from my mistakes, and I incorporate what I learn into my future behavior. Yes, I botched a joke. I'm never going to do that again. And with the help of Joan and Yakov, I'm going to make my delivery even better than my pickup, if you get where I'm going with that.
I think I do.
John is a natural at so many things. Great skier, looks good in a nice suit, you know. So it shouldn't be so hard to teach him how to tell a joke. Of course, it shouldn't be so hard to find a new husband for Melissa, either.
Sonny Lipschitz, the owner of club, invited me down to help with workshop for Senator. This slow week in Branson, and Joan, God bless her, I guess it's slow time for her, too, so we're both glad to help.
Okay, how many people want to hear that joke once more with the right timing?
Yeah.
Okay, Senator, the drunks have it.
Okay, so pause before wife?
Pause after wife, before cockle picker.
Before cockle picker. Got it.
But does he? The verdict isn't yet in.
I think a couple more workshops, he could tell jokes, you know, not like professional. Hey, I couldn't do whatever it is he does like professional, but certainly as good as, you know, after dinner speaker at major Rotary type event.
You know what I like about this man, aside from hair he could die for? Literally. I like that he's trying so hard. You know, personally, I think with that attitude, he should try screwing up the jokes more. See, that's the whole kind of postmodern kind of funny. At least that's what Melissa tells me.
Senator Kerry's advisors have scheduled another joke-telling workshop for next early Saturday morning, when his helper is scheduled to be Larry the Cable Guy's brother, Jim the Delivery Guy. I'm Ira Zitkin at the Comedy Pit.
And the fellow says to the agent, "Well, I'm sorry, but even Caruso had to clear up his throat." I think I put an up in there that shouldn't be there.
And for today, you've had it up to here. We had help from the Help Public Radio Foundation and from the Nan and Philip Rendon Foundation in support of Philip's desire to hear his name said more often. I'm Milton Getzler. Join us next week when we get you up to date. Up to speed, up to here. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
No matter where you go, no matter what you do.
bet. If you're in the South, he picks on you, bet. You may be in the East, he picks on you, bet. You may be in the West, he picks on you, bet. And he picks on you everywhere.
Ladies and gentlemen, there was a big news story in the United Kingdom this week. A report came out, the Stern report. It was the report that said that the United Kingdom had to really rejigger the whole economy, because if not, the economy would suffer so much more from the effects of global warming than from, I think they predicted 1% of GDP spent on preventing the climate change. The worst aspects of climate change would do the job, and made big news over there. But we had other fish to fry over here, you know, because he was buying meth. But meantime, won't you listen to this? News of the Warm?
Soft, listen to the warm.
Vast areas of shade cloth could soon cover parts of Australia's Great Barrier Reef to prevent the bleaching of coral. The shade cloth is one option being developed by marine researchers in Queensland. They say the cloth would be held in place by floating pontoons. Another option to protect important areas of coral being threatened by increasing ocean temperature is to spray the water surface, breaking the surface tension of the water, thus increasing the protection of the coral beneath from the sun. Tourism Minister Fran Bailey welcomed the shade cloth idea, saying it would help protect some of the most valuable areas of the reef. The opposition environment spokesman said the idea was absurd. There are 2,900 reefs altogether, the spokesman said. They cover an area larger than the UK and Ireland combined. So, that's a lot of shade cloth. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. What about an earth burka? The mention of the words Earth Burka, that's going to conclude this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, around the world through the facilities of American Forces Radio, and on your computer at two different locations wherever you live, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available as a free download from www.audible.com/theshow. On the giant 104 in West in all of Berlin, and available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And it'd be just like those of you in Los Angeles coming to see me 7 o'clock this Thursday in Barnes & Noble if you'd agree to join with me next week. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, and Chicago desks, and to Peter J. here at WLRN in Miami for making today's show possible. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from Miami. Get some crisis listening, won't you?